Hey everybody, Nate here. Before the show, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com. or order from Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors and they support us. Thanks and Nihei Debiru. Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks. Hey everybody and welcome to Chop Talk. This is your host, Nate England. Today's show is an interview with my good buddy and traveling partner, Randy Alley. Randy and I have been to Hawaii together, Okinawa, and I've even dog sat for him a couple of times. Randy's been in the martial arts for over 30 years and has seen quite a bit during that time. Today's show, he also opens up and talks about some of his experiences during Vietnam and some interesting and funny stories about running a skydiving school. Hope you enjoy. Randy, could you talk a little bit about how you got into karate, how you got into the martial arts? You started in what, 1981?
Yeah, I guess probably we had, my first introduction to any kind of martial arts, I did some boxing when I was younger, and then when I went to the Marine Corps, they taught us some throws and things to do, probably which was enough to get us hurt really bad. But you know, we had to practice a lot, the unit I was in. We got fairly good at doing what we did. And then when I got out of the Marine Corps, I was, I guess I was kind of like a lost soul.
Mm-hmm. This is approximately 1974.
Okay. I got out, 67th when I got out of the Marine Corps. And then 74, I started working for the railroad and, I had an anger management problem that was kind of held over from Vietnam, and
sure,
and I wasn't the most pleasant individual to be around, explosive to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And one night I was sitting talking with one of my friends, and he says, "Well, if you're worried about your controlling your temper," he says, "why don't you start taking the martial arts?" Says that teaches you a lot of self-control and teaches you how to handle bad situations. And if you go to school and you don't do what you're supposed to, they beat the crap out of you.
They keep you in line.
So you either learn the easy way or the hard way, right? And he said, well, more or less, but he says you won't have any trouble, you know. So I started looking at karate schools that were in the area where I lived, over around Niota and Hamilton, Illinois, and there was a Matsubayashi Shorinryu school in Keokuk. Fairly young guys were teaching that.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd both just been promoted to black belt.
Yeah.
And they'd been running the school as brown belts. And so that wasn't exactly what I was looking for. And I looked at a Taekwondo school that had a school in Fort Madison and in Keokuk. And I went there and kind of looked at that a little bit. Nah, that wasn't exactly what I was looking for. So I went up to Burlington. I went to a Taekwondo school, and then I went to a school that John Hutchcroft, Sensei Hutchcroft, ran.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Okinawan Shuriryu. So we talked a little bit, and I'd called him beforehand, and I still had my original notes from him where he'd told me how much it was going to be at home.
Oh, you called him on the phone and
the first time, and just then I went out and visited with him for about a half hour, 45 minutes one evening, and I joined the school and started taking karate, and it just kind of clicked, and I felt pretty comfortable with it, and then he moved to Michigan, and so then I went to the Matsubashi Shorinru School, and I really didn't care for that, so I didn't go there anymore, and I just kind of dropped out, but I always felt kind of incomplete, like I don't like to start something that I don't finish.
Right.
So over the years, about 18 years later, I met my wife, and I moved to Peoria area, and started looking for school, and I called Sensei Keppel School first, and he didn't return my call right away, and so I went to see another school that was the Academy of Okinawa Karate, and that was, when I walked in, I figured I was home because there was a pine tree on the wall and the USKA patch, and so I thought, well,
Just like back in Sensei Hedgecroft.
Yeah, just exactly. And so I joined that school, and about 2 weeks later, Sensei Keppel called me, and I said, I'm sorry, but I already joined another school. And he said, well, okay, bye.
Click.
Quick. Not going to waste his time.
Hung up on you. Yeah.
It wasn't. He did say bye. He didn't exactly hang up, but he did say bye. So, and I went to Walker School for nine and a half years, nine and three quarters years, and this last couple of years, I just decided that I might be time for me to move on. So I went to see Nate at a tournament in Peoria, and I run into my first karate teacher, John Hutchcroft, and I visited with him.
Nate being me.
Nate being Mr. England. My young friend. And so...
Yes, I was there with... I was at the tournament with the AWADs. They,
right.
You know, they were with, you know, Grandmaster Trias, but they also had studied under Master Keppel. And so when everybody... When Grandmaster Trias died and everybody kind of split up in their different directions, they went back with...
That was an interesting time. I was in Hutchcroft School when that happened. And
well, first of all, go back. What was your when you started training at Mr. Hutchcroft School? I mean, what was the early training like? What was a typical class like? How many people were there? What kind of things were you doing? Stuff like that.
Classes were, you didn't talk in class. Very seldom you smiled, never joked. Classes were all business. You'd have an hour class, you'd typically have a half hour of physical exercise and a half hour of training, usually 15 minutes on, say, ippons or kata or kihons or something like that. And then they'd have sparring too. And if you stayed for the second class, it was usually like an hour and a half, and so you'd have a half hour of calisthenics, and pretty rigorous, nonstop. And then you'd run katas and ippons and kihons and taisus and things like that. The standards had just come into being at that time for, they were put into place by Grandmaster Trias at that time. And so...
Because, I mean, before that, you know, he had a pretty diverse... organization.
Yeah, and it was, when he put the standards in place, that kind of solidified what you had to do to attain rank. And it was pretty well just laid out for you what you had to achieve.
You have to do these katas, you have to do these exercises.
These ippons, right. These taisus, these kihons, and as you advanced and had to attend so many hours of class. And it was pretty much just laid out. It was more like a class schedule than anything else.
Right.
Looking for great entertainment? Want to find the best deals on food and drinks? Use the PubPal app to find great establishments near you. View daily specials, find live bands, karaoke, even poetry. If you're looking for something to do, PubPal is the answer, and it's only a click away. Download the app on the Apple Store and get the Android app on Google Play. And don't forget to like them on Facebook. Visit PubPalUSA.com to find out more. That's PubPalUSA. PubPalUSA.
That went on till Sensei Hutchcroft moved to Michigan. I think when he moved to Michigan, I was a third-degree brown belt, and Shion Walker let me come back in as a third-degree brown belt, and it took me about a year and a half to make Nidan, or
NQ,
then about 6 months to make EQ.
Right. I remember that because I think when you started at that school, I was away at
University of Illinois.
University of Illinois, that's right. And so I saw you on and off whenever I'd be back in town for the weekend.
The first time that you really made an impression on me was at a...
Was it a good impression or a bad?
I wasn't really good at that time. It was at one of those seminars that Shihan put on.
Yeah.
ARC seminar.
Oh, the ARC. Yeah.
ARC seminar.
Yeah. It was Adrenaline Response Control.
Right.
You had to yell at everybody.
Yeah. And they had these guys dressed up like street hoodlums, and this tall guy comes up in front of me and looks at me, and he says something like, "All you Marines are baby rapers and killers," and something like that, I don't know. And it really hit a trigger in me. And if I remember right, you told me you thought I was going to kill you the way I looked at you, and you backed up about 3 feet.
I don't know if it was 3 feet. It might have been... It might have been 2.5. Yeah. Give me a little credit.
Yeah, I gave you a little credit. You thought I was going to attack you. Anyway.
Well, the thing is with the ARC seminars is that, you know, for anyone who hasn't been to one, the idea is to basically get them in a situation where they feel they are going to be attacked, or they're going to have that adrenaline going through their system, so they can learn how to deal with that when that happens. Because normally, I mean, even if you practice karate every day, you're not in any kind of situation where someone's really attacking you. You're not right. In any kind of emergency situation.
Right.
So the nice thing about these seminars is they put you in that. You know, even though it's not real, it's in a seminar, you can get that same sort of feeling. And
was really funny was that Nate had got the feeling more than I did.
Well, I mean, you know, And that was the thing, you know, when I came back and people said, "Oh, this new guy's in class and he's, you know, real tough and he's this and that," you know, I don't know if you're going to be able to get to him. I'm like, I'll be able to get to him. I'll be able to get a reaction. And the thing was, I got the reaction. You know, I said something that I knew was going to hit you, that was going to get...
Think it was quite the reaction you expected, though.
Maybe not, but it was a reaction. I mean, it was, yeah, you're surprised, you know, I'm going to go get you, but you know, if I'd come up and say, "Hey, man, you know, give me all your money," you know, that probably wouldn't have had the same...
I just laughed at you.
Exactly, it would have had the same effect, so I figured I had to go all out from the beginning.
Yeah, he passed an insult that didn't set well.
But that was my job, you know, that was what I was supposed to do.
Yeah, I know that's what you really believe, though.
That is true. You are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway... that was the first time I met him, and then over a period of time, we got to be pretty good friends, and
yeah.
We ended up going on a trip to Okinawa, and became better friends and over the years, and I continued to advance, and finally, after 6 3/4 years, I was reviewed for Shodan and passed that test, and it was a pretty good trip, really. I mean... everything has its ups and downs, and peaks and valleys and stuff that you deal with and you go on. And so I moved on here this year. I've had some issues with my back and stuff, and so I just decided that my chiropractor had been telling me that if I didn't change my lifestyle and quit participating in activities that aggravate my situation, is what he said. So I moved on to a different style of karate. It's with Mr. Keppel. It's called Matsumura Sato Shorinru. And back in the 80s, and how this relates is that when this all came about, I guess the stories I get are varied, but
yeah, everyone has their own. Yeah.
But basically what happened, there was several people that decided Shuri-Ryu was not a true style karate. And throughout the ages, every master has created his own style of karate by drawing up of other styles of karate that he wanted to use and creating some own things of his own. And basically, when you get to a certain level in karate, you start to put in your own stuff. Mm-hmm. You still know what the formal interpretation is, or bunkai, but you change a strike. Yeah, I don't like this strike because it doesn't fit me, and so you change it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's basically how all karate's evolved.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if I'd have stayed with Mr. Hutchcroft at that time, I'd have never participated in Shuri-Ryu again.
Well, until he switched. I mean, he switched approximately.
He switched.
When he moved to Michigan, or?
Well, he actually, the change came before he went to Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Mr. Randy Holman was a chief instructor. John Hutchcroft was a chief instructor. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Keppel was a chief instructor. And I think they went to talk to Grandmaster Trias at the time and confronted him. And I guess confronting Grandmaster Trias didn't really go well because they were all out of the Trias International Society and they were all out of the USKA and they were all no longer chief instructors. And
yeah, I've got the impression that he's maybe not the best person to cross.
Yeah, I met the man once and I could see where if he was pushed. I met him a couple times actually, and he signed a couple pinnacles for me, but the thing is that he just struck me as a kind of individual that was tough, set, and he had earned his position, and if you wanted to challenge him, you could challenge him, but you were going to lose.
Right.
And so Mr. Holman went his way, and I know from research that I've done and talking to other people, he hasn't had another teacher since 1986 when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Still doesn't to this day, but claims to be a 10th Don. And then Mr. Keppel has studied under many noted people, Richard Kim and Adrian Imperato, and
He's sort of really
Kisei, and
he's really, I mean, built up his organization.
Oh yeah, he created the United States Karate Dokai.
Right.
And they have membership from all over the world.
Sure.
And I just I had to, this Matsumura Saito Shorinryu is called the old man's karate, and the stances are more upright, more natural stances, and they don't hurt my back. But I was around when all this politics hit and everything was going on, and it was a trying time.
Yeah.
Ron Lindsay came up from Texas, and we all went to Mr. Mills' dojo in the Quad Cities and met. And worked out and started to learn the new styles and stuff. And I really didn't like Mr. Lindsay the first time. I haven't met him since. Once was enough at that time.
what was it about him that...
He's just arrogant.
Mm.
Just kind of aloof, you know.
Yeah.
I'm better than you. You're nothing, you know.
Right.
I'm just me. I could care less if a guy's a 10th Don or a EQ or a white belt, you know. It's just, I'm just not that way.
Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, coworker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks.
So I guess you could say that I'm a piece of history in a way, because I was around when all that took place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Couldn't really find another style of karate until I came over to Mr. Walker's school, 2002.
I remember you. You said when you signed up, and you told him you were a brown belt with Mr. Hutchcroft.
Right.
He said,
if you're one of Mr. Hutchcroft's brown belts, you were a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And so he let me stay a sans cue.
Right.
He says you'll have to work hard and play catch up.
Right.
So I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I did. And it's been a pleasant journey. Mm-hmm. The guy that told me that martial arts would help control my temper and stuff, it's made a more peaceful individual out of me than what I was. Mm-hmm. I have a gray area now.
Before,
small but gray.
Before it was black and white.
Black and white. And either or, no. More, no quarter.
More black than white, or was it 50-50?
Probably. Probably. Yeah, it didn't take much to get me to fire.
Right.
And so I just, I like me better now because of the martial arts. It's really good. And there's been a lot of stuff go on. I've had a drop zone, and I taught about 2,000 people to skydive.
Yeah, it used to be when you were in the Marines, you learned how to skydive. That's where you first learned how to
I learned how to parachute jump.
Right.
And then
afterwards you ran your own skydiving business for a while.
About 12 years.
Okay.
And you learn to judge people real quick. People that worked for me hated me on Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings. We'd have class and I'd walk in and I'd listen to class and I'd be off the side setting up the different loads, and I knew which jump masters needed to have problem children and which ones didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times in the beginning, when I was the only jump master, you learn how to handle this really quickly. And
right.
So as I skydivers come along and promoted and got to be get their ratings and became jump masters, I'd let them jump master several people, and then I'd say, oh, well, it's about time they had some fun. And I'd give them a couple, three good ones in a row, just one on a load, and then I'd load them up with about three bad ones where they'd almost have a cat fight in the airplane. And I'd walk in there and I'd start making these loads up and they'd just start shaking their heads.
Wow. So any good stories from the jump master days? Any parachutes that didn't open, or any...
I've had some of that.
Horror stories on the way down? Or?
Well, I guess I held a lot of ratings. I was a static line jump master and I was a basic instructional course director. I taught people how to be jump masters and instructors.
Mm-hmm.
I was a static line instructor, and I was a parachute rigger. I still am a parachute rigger. And I've been a safety and training advisor for the United States Parachute Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I've saved my own life a couple times and several others. And it's funny to see how people react. You know, some mm-hmm. of them come back and they're wet themselves and they said, your parachute worked, you know, you saved my life, and you got a bottle of whiskey in their hand, you know. And
mm-hmm.
then it's kind of fun. You know, this one young lady come to me and she wanted a reserve repack. And I says, okay. And I said, well, open it up. She's waiting. And I says, well, it's going to open anyway. You might as well practice opening it. See what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
Pull your cutaway handle and pull the reserve handle. She pulled the cutaway handle, and she pulled and pulled and pulled and pulled and couldn't get the reserve handle to move.
Wow, so this is in the air?
No, this is on the ground.
On the ground, okay.
This was in my living room.
Okay.
And she's sitting there jerking on a handle, and I said, you might as well stop, you're dead. I says, if you're not strong enough to pull that handle, you're not going to get your reserve out, and you're going to hit the ground.
Mm.
So I put a scale on it. Well, a reserve handle is supposed to have like maybe 12 to 15 pounds of pressure, if I remember right, at the mm-hmm. very most. And that one had 60.
Wow.
And it took everything I had to pull it to get the 60-pound rating on it.
Yeah.
And so I got to looking inside and started inspecting, and I says, who packed this reserve for you? And she says, my boyfriend. I says, really? I says, he's still your boyfriend? And she says, no, we broke up a while back. I says, really? And I said, that's a good thing. How many jumps you get on this? She says, well, about 100. And I says, well, you were lucky 100 times that you packed real well. And she looked at me, she says, what do you mean? I said, couldn't pull the handle. If your main hadn't opened, you were going to die.
Wow.
And so when I got the rig open, I looked at it, and the steering toggles weren't even tied onto the steering lines on the reserve parachute.
So even if it had opened,
she would have been able to steer it.
Just wherever the wind blew her.
Yep.
Wow.
And
so that was, sounds deliberate. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I called the master rigger that had trained me and gave him the information, and he turned the guy into the FAA, and he lost his rigger's license. They come and they wanted to see my records. I had pictures of everything, and they took his license.
Wow, they booted him. Well, yeah, because
he's trying to kill her.
Attempted murder, right?
Yeah. I've had him come in where I opened one reserve up, and it had knife holes through it. Somebody had run knife holes through the side of the container. I said, did you make somebody mad? And the guy said, why? And I said, well, look at these holes in the side of your containers. I said, those are puncture wounds. And when we pulled his parachute out and hung it up, there was all kinds, because they're packed small, and there's just all kinds of holes and lines cut and everything done inside.
Because it's all folded up. You punch through. It's like making a paper snowflake, right?
Yeah. It just makes all kind of like making a snowflake. It's going to cause the parachute to blow up. And turned out his girlfriend had done that.
Wow.
I mean, there's some really nice people in this world.
Looking for great entertainment? Want to find the best deals on food and drinks? Use the PubPal app to find great establishments near you. View daily specials, find live bands, karaoke, even poetry. If you're looking for something to do, PubPal is the answer, and it's only a click away. Download the app on the Apple Store and get the Android app on Google Play. And don't forget to like them on Facebook. Visit PubPalUSA.com to find out more. That's PubPalUSA. PubPalUSA.
I suppose the worst parachute jump that I had, well, there was two. One, I was doing some test jumping for a parachute company, and I had a really hard opening. I mean, it almost knocked me out. And when I looked up, the three center cells on the parachute were gone. It was just the seams and thread holding the parachute together. And so...
Which are the three center cells? So there's three pieces that hold...
Well, there were seven cells, and there's two on each outside, but the three center cells, where there was nothing there, it just blew the nylon completely out of the...
So you're just looking up at a hole.
Yeah, blue sky. And all these seams, where it was doubled, it was there, and that's all that was holding the parachute together.
Wow.
And the people on the ground said it sounded like a high-powered rifle going off when that parachute opened. I said it felt like one. And then I had a guy I was doing a tandem jump. That's the easiest way there is for a skydiver to die. If you really feel stupid, do tandem jumps. That's where you jump with somebody on your chest.
But sure.
I had to do that.
This is how you have to... If you want to skydive for the first time, this is how you have to do it.
Not how you had to do it, but that's what a lot of people just wanted to make one jump, so they'd want to do a tandem jump.
Uh-huh.
They wear a harness that hooks to your harness, and this guy seemed all right. And somewhere along the line, as I was opening the parachute, he managed to open the reserve into the main, and so we're dipping and diving through the sky. And
so he has two parachutes open
at the same time. And I tried to maneuver one, and the other one had collapsed, and then I'd move over the other one, and the other one would collapse. And so I'm sitting there playing the guessing game of how I'm going to get this done, and it only do right turns. So I'm doing these right turns trying to get over the airport, and this guy, he's hooping and hollering and having a good time because we're diving 100 feet and back up and back down, you know.
He has no idea that
this is a serious situation.
He's just enjoying the ride.
And cameraman had it all on video, so I don't even look at the video. Scares the hell out of me today, and that's been several years ago. So finally, when we get to the ground, I thought, you know, I said, if I time this just right, I might live. And all the time this is going on, I was thinking, here I am gonna die with this guy screaming and having a good time on my chest. And he doesn't realize what's going on. So we come in, and I timed it right. We hit the ground a little hard, but neither one of us had any broken bones.
Wow.
And I stood up. And I never drank. The rule was at my drop zone that when the airplane was out, people were jumping, there's no alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I just walked in and I grabbed two beers. I went over and sat down in a chair and I jugged both of them. Just chugged them straight down. Everybody's just looking at me and they said I was white as a sheet. And I was pretty scared. I thought I was going to die, really.
That was the closest you came.
That's one of the closest. I figured I was a dead man, really. I was just trying to slow things down and I might end up just a cripple. And this kid, he's over there watching a video whooping and hollering. And one of my skydivers told me this, and he says, you don't even realize what happened, do you? And he says, no, they run the video back, and it showed him pulling the emergency cord, one of the emergency, they had several methods for a tandem master in case he was disabled or something, and he had pulled one of the emergency handles up on my shoulder. He'd reached clear back up over his shoulder and pulled it.
Wow.
I didn't even realize it until it was too late. And so he's sitting there, and they're saying, look, you almost died. He said, Randy saved your life. And he came over and looked at me, and he says, I want to thank you for saving my life. And I wasn't in a real good mood, and I just said, you know, I can't really tell you what I said to him because you're going to put this on the internet.
I told you I can edit anything out.
So I said, you dumb SOB. I says, I wasn't freaking trying to save your life. I was trying to save Randy, and you were just along for the ride. And if I could have cut you away, I'd have cut you away and watched you flap your wings 17,000 RPMs a minute and stay aloft. And he looked at me, and he just turned around and went around the building and threw up.
Wow.
And somebody brought me a certificate. I signed it. I went out behind the building. I said, you guys jump all you want. I looked at one of my Packers, and I says, about every 10 minutes, just bring me another beer for a while.
All right, and that does it for part one of my interview with Randy Alley. I hope he's forgiven me for calling him a baby raper, but just in case, I am never going skydiving with a man. Tune in next week, where he shares a couple more interesting stories about running the skydiving school, and we also talk about our different times in Okinawa. Randy was there in the 60s during Vietnam, and visited with me again in the 2000s. So we talk about some of the comparisons and differences, and the way that the islands changed during that time. All right, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Mata ya. Everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks.